Chapter 41. So far, good. If any man has a right to feel proud of himself and satisfied, surely it is one. For I have written about the Colosseum and the gladiators, the martyrs and the lions, and yet have never once used the phrase "uttered" to make a Roman holiday. I am the only free white man of mature age who has accomplished this since Byron originated the expression. Butchered to make a Roman holiday sounds well for the first 17 or 1800,000 times one sees it in print, but after that it begins to grow tiresome. I find it in all the books concerning Rome, and here latterly it reminds me of Judge Oliver. Oliver was a young lawyer, fresh from the schools, who had gone out to the deserts of Nevada to begin life. He found that country, and our ways of life, there, in those early days, different from life in New England or Paris. But he put on a woolen shirt, and strapped a navy revolver to his person, took to the bacon and beans of the country, and determined to do in Nevada as Nevada did. Oliver accepted the situation so completely that, although he must have sorrowed over many of his trials, he never complained, that is, he never complained but once. He, two others, and myself, started to the new silver mines in the Humboldt Mountains, he to be probate judge of Humboldt County, and we to mine. The distance was 200 miles. It was dead of winter. We bought a two-horse wagon and put 1,800 pounds of bacon, flour, beans, blasting powder, picks and shovels in it. We bought two sorry-looking Mexican lugs, with the hair turned the wrong way and more corners on their bodies than there are on the Muscovomer. We hitched up and started. It was a dreadful trip. But Oliver did not complain. The horses dragged the wagon 2 miles from town, and then gave out. Then we three pushed the wagon 7 miles, and Oliver moved ahead, and pulled the horses after him by the bits. We complained, but Oliver did not. The ground was frozen, and it froze our backs while we slept. The wind swept across our faces and froze our noses. Oliver did not complain. 5 days of pushing the wagon by day and freezing by night brought us to the bad part of the journey, the 40-mile desert, or the Great American Desert, if you please. Still, this mildest-mannered man that ever was had not complained. We started across at 8 in the morning, pushing through sand that had no bottom, toiling all day long by the wrecks of 1,000 wagons, the skeletons of 10,000 oxen, by wagon tires enough to hoop the Washington Monument to the top, and ox chains enough to girdle Long Island, by human graves, with our throats parched always, with thirst, lips bleeding from the alkali dust, hungry, perspiring, and very, very weary, so weary that when we dropped in the sand every 50 yards to rest the horses, we could hardly keep from going to sleep. No complaints from Oliver. None the next morning at 3 o'clock, when we got across, tired to death. Awakened 2 or 3 nights afterward at midnight, in a narrow canyon, by the snow falling on our faces, and appalled at the imminent danger of being snowed in, we harnessed up and pushed until 8 in the morning, past the Ivide, and knew we were saved. No complaints. 15 days of hardship and fatigue brought us to the end of the 200 miles, and the judge had not complained. We wondered if anything could exasperate him. We built a Humboldt house. It is done in this way. You dig a square in the steep base of the mountain, and set up 2 uprights, and top them with 2 joists. Then you stretch a great sheet of cotton domestic from the point where the joists join the hillside down over the joists to the ground. This makes the roof and the front of the mansion. The sides and back are the dirt walls your digging has left. A chimney is easily made by turning up one corner of the roof. Oliver was sitting alone in this dismal den one night by a sagebrush fire, writing poetry. He was very fond of digging poetry out of himself or blasting it out when it came hard. He heard an animal's footsteps close to the roof. A stone or two and some dirt came through and fell by him. He grew uneasy and said, "Aye, clear out from there, can't you?" From time to time, But by and by he fell asleep where he sat, and pretty soon a mule fell down the chimney. The fire flew in every direction, and Oliver went over backwards. About 10 nights after that, he recovered confidence enough to go to writing poetry again. Again he dozed off to sleep, and again a mule fell down the chimney. This time, about half of that side of the house came in with the mule. Struggling to get up, the mule kicked the candle out and smashed most of the kitchen furniture and raised considerable dust. These violent awakenings must have been annoying to Oliver, but he never complained. He moved to a mansion on the opposite side of the cannon, because he had noticed the mules did not go there. One night about 8 o'clock he was endeavoring to finish his poem, when a stone rolled in, then a hoof appeared below the canvas, then part of a cow, the after part. He leaned back in dread, and shouted, "Hooey! Hooey! Get out of this!" And the cow struggled manfully, lost ground steadily, dirt and dust streamed down, and before Oliver could get well away, the entire cow crashed through onto the table, and made a shapeless wreck of everything. Then, for the first time in his life, I think, Oliver complained. He said, "This thing is growing monotonous." Then he resigned his judgeship and left Humboldt County. Ushered to make a Roman holy day has grown monotonous to me. In this connection I wish to say one word about Michelangelo Buonarroti. I used to worship the mighty genius of Michelangelo, that man who was great in poetry, painting, sculpture, architecture, great in everything he undertook. But I do not want Michelangelo for breakfast, for luncheon, for dinner, for tea, for supper, for between meals. I like a change, occasionally. In Genoa, he designed everything. In Milan here his pupils designed everything. He designed the Lake of Como. In Padua, Verona, Venice, Bologna, who did we ever hear of, from guides, but Michelangelo? In Florence, he painted everything, designed everything, nearly, and what he did not design he used to sit on a favorite stone and look at, and they showed us the stone. In Pisa he designed everything but the old shot tower, and they would have attributed that to him, if it had not been so awfully out of the perpendicular. He designed the piers of Leghorn, and the custom house regulations of Civita Vecchia. But, here it is frightful. He designed St. Peter's. He designed the Pope. He designed the Pantheon, the uniform of the Pope's soldiers, the Tiber, the Vatican, the Colosseum, the Capitol, the Tarpeian Rock, the Barberini Palace, St. John Lateran, the Campagna, the Appian Way, the Seven Hills, the Baths of Caracalla, the Claudian Aqueduct, the Cloaca Maxima, the Eternal Boar, designed the Eternal City, and unless all men and books do lie, he painted everything in it. Dan said the other day to the guide, "Enough, enough, enough. Say no more. Lump the whole thing. Say that the creator made Italy from designs by Michelangelo." I never felt so fervently thankful, so soothed, so tranquil, so filled with a blessed peace, as I did yesterday, when I learned that Michelangelo was dead. But we have taken it out of this guide. He has marched us through miles of pictures and sculpture in the vast corridors of the Vatican, and through miles of pictures and sculpture in 20 other palaces. He has shown us the great picture in the Sistine Chapel, and frescoes enough to fresco the heavens, pretty much all done by Michelangelo. So with him, we have played that game which has vanquished so many guides for us, imbecility and idiotic questions. These creatures never suspect, they have no idea of a sarcasm. He shows us a figure, and says colon statue bronzo. Bronze statue. We look at it indifferently, and the doctor asks colon by Michelangelo? No, not no who. Then he shows us the ancient Roman forum. The doctor asks colon Michelangelo? A stare from the guide. Oh, 1,000 years, before he is born. Then an Egyptian obelisk. Again colon Michelangelo? Oh, mon dieu, gentlemen. This is 2,000 years, before he is born. He grows so tired of that unceasing question sometimes, that he dreads to show us anything at all. The wretch has tried all the ways he can think of to make us comprehend that Michelangelo is only responsible for the creation of a part of the world, but somehow he has not succeeded yet. Relief for overtasked eyes and brain from study and sightseeing is necessary, or we shall become idiotic sure enough. Therefore this guide must continue to suffer. If he does not enjoy it, so much the worse for him. We do. In this place I may as well jot down a chapter concerning those necessary nuisances, European guides. Many a man has wished in his heart he could do without his guide, but knowing he could not, has wished he could get some amusement out of him as a remuneration for the affliction of his society. We accomplished this latter matter, and if our experience can be made useful to others they are welcome to it. Guides know about enough English to tangle everything up, so that a man can make neither head or tail of it. They know their story by heart, the history of every statue, painting, cathedral or other wonder they show you. They know it, and tell it as a parrot would, and if you interrupt, and throw them off the track, they have to go back, and begin over again. All their lives long, they are employed in showing strange things to foreigners and listening to their bursts of admiration. It is human nature to take delight in exciting admiration. It is what prompts children to say smart things, and do absurd ones, and in other ways show off when company is present. It is what makes gossips turn out in rain and storm to go, and be the first, to tell a startling bit of news. Think, then, what a passion it becomes with a guide, whose privilege it is, every day, to show to strangers wonders that throw them into perfect ecstasies of admiration. He gets so that he could not by any possibility live in a soberer atmosphere. After we discovered this, we never went into ecstasies anymore, we never admired anything, we never showed any, but impassible faces and stupid indifference in the presence of the sublimest wonders a guide had to display. We had found their weak point. We have made good use of it ever since. We have made some of those people savage, at times, but we have never lost our own serenity. The doctor asks the questions, generally, because he can keep his countenance, and look more like an inspired idiot, and throw more imbecility into the tone of his voice than any man that lives. It comes natural to him. The guides in Genoa are delighted to secure an American party, because Americans so much wonder, and deal so much in sentiment and emotion before any relic of Columbus. Our guide there fidgeted about, as if he had swallowed a spring mattress. He was full of animation, full of impatience. He said, "Come with me, gentlemen. Come. I show you the letter writing by Christopher Colombo. Write it himself. Write it with his own hand. Come." He took us to the municipal palace. After much impressive fumbling of keys and opening of locks, the stained and aged document was spread before us. The guide's eyes sparkled. He danced about us, and tapped the parchment with his finger. "What I tell you, gentlemen. Is it not so? See. Handwriting Christopher Colombo. Write it himself." We looked indifferent, unconcerned. The doctor examined the document very deliberately, during a painful pause. Then he said, without any show of interest, "Ah, Ferguson, what did you say was the name of the party who wrote this?" "Christopher Colombo, the great Christopher Colombo." Another deliberate examination. "Ah, did he write it himself, or how?" "He write it himself. Christopher Colombo. His own handwriting, right by himself." Then the doctor laid the document down and said, "Why, I have seen boys in America only 14 years old, that could write better than that. But this is the great Christo, I don't care who it is. It's the worst writing I ever saw. Now you mustn't think you can impose on us, because we are strangers. We are not fools, by a good deal. If you have got any specimens of penmanship of real merit, trot them out. And if you haven't, drive on." We drove on. The guide was considerably shaken up, but he made one more venture. He had something which he thought would overcome us. He said, Ah, gentlemen, you come with me. I show you beautiful, oh, magnificent, bus Christopher Colombo. Splendid, grand, magnificent. He brought us before the beautiful bust, for it was beautiful, and sprang back, and struck an attitude. Ah, look, gentlemen. Beautiful, grand, bus Christopher Colombo. Beautiful bust, beautiful pedestal. The doctor put up his eyeglass, procured for such occasions. Ah, what did you say this gentleman's name was? Christopher Colombo. The great Christopher Colombo. Christopher Colombo, the great Christopher Colombo. Well, what did he do? Discover America. Discover America, oh, the devil. Discover America. No, that statement will hardly wash. We are just from America ourselves. We heard nothing about it. Christopher Colombo, pleasant name, is he dead? Oh, corpo di bacco. 300 years. What did he die of? I do not know. I cannot tell. Smallpox, think. I do not know, gentlemen. I do not know what he died of. Measles, likely? Maybe, I do not know, I think he died of some things. Parents living? Impossible. Ah, which is the bust, and which is the pedestal? Santa Maria. This the bust. This the pedestal. Ah, I see, happy combination, very happy combination, indeed. Is this the first time this gentleman was ever on a bust? That joke was lost on the foreigner. Guides cannot master the subtleties of the American joke. We have made it interesting for this Roman guide. Yesterday we spent 3 or 4 hours in the Vatican, again, that wonderful world of curiosities. We came very near expressing interest, sometimes even admiration. It was very hard to keep from it. We succeeded though. Nobody else ever did, in the Vatican museums. The guide was bewildered, nonplussed. He walked his legs off, nearly, hunting up extraordinary things, and exhausted all his ingenuity on us, but it was a failure. We never showed any interest in anything. He had reserved what he considered to be his greatest wonder till the last, a royal Egyptian mummy, the best preserved in the world, perhaps. He took us there. He felt so sure, this time, that some of his old enthusiasm came back to him. See, gentlemen. Mummy. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.